Wayne Oates of the University of Louisville School of Medicine speaks on bioethical issues in behavior control.
At the outset, I would like to tell you the areas in which I am working and from which I draw a good deal of the information I have here. As a professor in the University of Louisville School of Medicine, my first assignment is to participate as a pastoral advisor and theological consultant in a child evaluation center where my students and I are part of a team that evaluate 1,000 families a year who have had birth defect or mentally retarded and or mentally retarded children. The second situation in which I spend 3 full days a week is in the large emergency psychiatric clinic, inpatient and outpatient, at Louisville General Hospital, where we see 200, 300 patients a month, over half of whom are suicidal by having attempted to do so. And then the third area in which I work is in supervising psychiatric residents in Norton Psychiatric Clinic, which is operated by the Department of Psychiatry of the medical school. Here we minister to adolescents. We have an adolescent unit and an adult unit. Now, with that as a background, let me give you 2 cases that will identify what we mean by behavior when we think of bioethical issues and behavior control. Sometimes in theological settings, we develop very rarefied atmospheres as to what behavior means. And however, in a clinical setting, the 2 cases that I will explain to you will illustrate what I mean by behavior. This is a 26-year-old white male who is a Vietnam veteran of the Marines and who is the girlfriend, who is the boyfriend of a girl whom we have had as a patient. This girl was admitted in February in an open psychotic state. After having gone to church with this particular man, and that's where she first broke down mentally and was admitted to the hospital. However, they lived at a boarding house in which he had one room, she had another, and he had full visiting rights in the fullest meaning of that word. And he was intimately and sexually involved with her. She stayed in the hospital about 6 weeks and was dismissed in remission and then took a place in the YWCA. And our first observation of this young man's behavior arose when he got into a verbal and physical brawl with her in the lobby of the YWCA and physically dragged her to his car against her will. And later, she told us she feared for her life. The point of contact with him on this last occasion was that he had had a warrant sworn out against him for harassment of her because, having moved 3 times to get away from him, she finally took out a warrant. And the people in the boarding house where she lived would not let him in for fear that he might hurt her or hurt some of them. In getting his history upon his having come in asking for our help, and the reason he came in was he thought maybe we could get her to come in and he could talk with her in our presence. we were bait to get her to come see him. And in talking with him, we discovered that this young man had been in jail 3 times for assault and battery. One of these times, his father had had him arrested. Another of the times, his mother had had him arrested for having assaulted them. And he had a long history, according to them, of flying into rages and assaulting people, and admitted to us himself that his biggest problem was that he, as he was growing up, he just had to fight with someone every day. Now, how do you control that behavior? It's aggressive, hostile, assaultive behavior in which we fear that he will kill somebody. And he demonstrated the behavior in our offices because we sought to ask him to be admitted to the hospital, and he flew into a rage with us, accused us of wanting nothing but his money. It was a charity clinic, and we had not asked him for anything. And he arose and became threatening toward us and stomped out of the place in an anger. I was bigger than he was. That's one type of behavior. Another type of behavior is illustrated by a 34-year-old man who has been, who is a very intellectually equipped person. He is in the last phases of his doctor's degree in a university, or he was before he went into his psychotic episode of an acute depression filled with delusions and attempted suicide. And for 12 years, this man's been under psychoanalytic treatment in another city. And he came back to our city, where his family of origin is. And it was at this time he attempted suicide a second time. And it was a very lethal attempt. And he has been in Norton Psychiatric Clinic for 9 months. And each day he vows that as soon as he is out of the hospital, he will kill himself. And the hospital is a form of control of his behavior. Now, the clinical task in a hospital or in the care of psychiatric patients is controlling behavior like that. Now then, what do we, at the outset, what would we say is right when it comes to controlling people's behavior? I was trying to find the definition of what the word right means. And I went to an old friend of college days named Immanuel Kant, who has a treatise on what right means, and he defines right this way: act externally in such a manner that the free exercise of your will may be able to coexist with the freedom of all others according to a universal law. Act externally in such a manner that the free exercise of your will may be able to coexist with the freedom of all other people's will. And he calls that right. And ethics imposes upon me, he says, the obligation to make the fulfillment of right a maxim of my conduct. And my task here is to do 3 things. First, to identify the specific technologies of behavior control now in use in fields of psychology and psychiatry that attempt in a very crude and rudimentary way to see to it that people behave in such a way that not only their will is free, but that the wills of other people are free. To study those technologies. And the second is to clarify some and state some major ethical issues involved in the use of these technologies, insofar as inherent ambiguity of human life will permit. And the third task is to relate these tools and issues to our knowledge of God as we've been enabled to know God in Jesus Christ. And at the outset, I would like to ask, what is behavior control from a psychological and a psychiatric point of view? It refers to the personal or technological power to intervene in the functions of another person, the emotional functions of the other person and the behavioral patterns of another person and even the belief patterns of another person are intervened in such ways as to cause that person to conform to pre-chosen emotions, behaviors, and beliefs of the person or persons doing the intervening. In short, behavior control refers to the use of psychological and or psychiatric technology to alter the thought and behavior of individuals. Now, earlier the issues concerning behavior control concerned the voluntary and indeterminate commitment of mentally ill patients to hospitals. And this concern still exists because the hospital was used as a technology of control. However, now we grope with the fear that technologists of behavior control will exercise their will freely without regard to the freedom of other persons whom they treat, and thus patients will be subtly or forthrightly deprived of their human freedom. Now, what are some of these technologies of behavior control? And this reminds me of a story that I learned in Eastern North Carolina as a pastor, that there was a salesman going through the area and he got lost. And he asked a young rural boy there how he could find his way to Spring Hope, North Carolina. And the little boy said, "Well, do you know where Seven Paths is?" He said, "No." He said, "Well, do you know where Tar River Bridge is?" He said, "No." He said, "Well, do you know where Peachtree Creek is?" He said, "No." And any question the little boy asked him, the man was ignorant of. And he finally said, "Well, mister, before I can tell you something, you got to know something." Now, that's where I am when I've just been out in the jungle of all of the technologies that psychiatry and psychology use in the control of human behavior. And I got to tell you something before, you've got to know something before I can tell you something. You've got to know what these technologies are. And so I'm going to list them rather quickly. And the first technology is known as milieu therapy, or environment therapy. Milieu therapy is a scientific program of the environment of hospital situation with the objective of changing the personality of the patient. Schedules of activity such as art therapy, recreational therapy, group therapy, music therapy, relaxation therapy, group activities such as buffets, picnics, dances, card games, etc. are arrayed around other treatments such as drug therapy and shock therapy with the idea of creating a more ideal community in which the person can experience a different way of life from the way he has known or she has known before. And optimally to set up a new set of habits that will teach the person a new way of life. Now, the ethical issue involved in this particular technology is the cost of the kind of treatment to the rest of the family. And also, there's an ethical issue involved in that it can be a means for doctors paying less attention to their patients. Also, it can be a bureaucratic method of treating people, in which the staff gets together as a staff and tries to decide about the treatment of the patient. And staff indecision and staff conflict become ethical issues. And one patient put it this way. He said, "I spend all my week with people who are the least responsible for my getting out of the hospital and the least equipped to treat me. And I rarely get to see the person who makes a decision as to whether I am kept in the hospital or discharged." There's an ethical issue. Now, the second form of behavior control is one that you know much about, and that's individual psychotherapy, in which a patient, for purposes of ventilation, re-education, clarification, interpretation, modeling, and the use of many modalities for removing feelings of alienation, rejection, sadness, guilt, aggression, and unrest in the interpersonal relationship between an individual psychotherapist and the patient. Now, the critical ethical issue here is the length of the treatment process. And this is where the battle is fought back and forth in psychotherapy. This is a critical issue as to how long this treatment is going on. Insurance companies are taking new looks at this. Champus says to a Champus Insurance, which is a prototype of national health insurance, if we ever get it, if it ever comes our way, Champus is the insurance company that insures government employees. And it is the working model whereby decisions are made. And now they are saying to a psychotherapist, we will pay for the first 8 interviews without question. At the end of the first 20 interviews, we expect a written diagnosis, plan of treatment, and prognosis. And at the end of 60 interviews, we expect a review of your treatment plan by a peer review organization to psychotherapists, which indicates that there is an issue in how long this therapy is going on, because other problems arise there of the emotional exploitation of the client for personal purposes, the expense of the treatment, and so on. Now then there is group psychotherapy. This is a third modality. And group psychotherapy does deal with isolation, brokenness, behavioral deviance of a given individual by relating the person to other people. The critical issue that arises in this kind of modality is the relationship of the group to other groups in the larger community. Those of you who are pastors know this in its garden variety form, in which small groups will form within the church without reference to the rest of the group. It occurs in group therapy too. A second issue is, does the member of the group have a right to discuss with, let us say, his or her spouse outside the group, or with some other person what goes on inside the group, especially when those other persons are responsible for the behavior that is generated in the group? And then there's that ever perennial critical issue as to the degree to which groups are used as an easy answer to saving money on personnel. Now then we get into some more specific technologies, such as, I think in the fourth place, drug therapy. And we need to talk about drug therapy in several different categories. There is such a thing as, in the first place, maintenance control drugs. maintenance control drugs. Let us say an epileptic patient, which is one of the most common problems we run into. If that person can stay on their Dilantin and or phenobarbital, you have a maintenance kind of control of seizures. For hyperkinetic children, for acting out aggressive children, Ritalin, R-I-T-A-L-I-N, is used as a maintenance control technique. For compulsive, obsessional, anxiety-ridden people who want to continue their work, nevertheless, minor tranquilizers such as Librium and Valium are used in controlling muscle spasms, controlling hysteria and acute grief reactions, and enabling highly compulsive people to work more effectively. Now these are maintenance control things. For that matter, you find it in the use of antihistamines as a maintenance control factor on hay fever, asthma, etc., etc. That's one type of drug. Another type of drug is your antidepressant, in which mood-changing drugs are administered on the hypothesis that several chemicals in the bloodstream are either in too great a supply or too small a supply, such as the chemicals of epinephrine, norepinephrine, dopamine, and serotonin, that these nourish the nerve connections in the ganglia of the nervous system, and if they are there in proper quantity, then the patient is not depressed. But if in the wrong quantity, then the patient becomes depressed. And such drugs as Tofranil or Elavil and other closely related tricyclic compounds are being used to control depressions. Of course, that kind of behavior and manic depressive behavior is moving toward maintenance control types of drugs, such as the use of lithium carbonate with manic patients, or such as the use of Prolixin with schizophrenic patients, in which the patient can take an injection once every 2 weeks, let us say, and there is not the issue as to whether or not this person will remember to take his medication or decide to take his medication and so on. And the relationship between the physician and the patient is continued and sustained through the regular revisiting on a 2 week basis. Now, this is the antidepressant, anti-manic behavior type of drug. I know one patient who's very dear to me, a man who's about 50 now, the son of a former colleague of mine who's now long since dead, who before this particular drug of lithium was produced was just as sick as he could be. But now he's a very productive person, kind of crazy, but the world is moving nearer to his position, and yet he is highly creative in his particular line of work and produces some remarkably impressive types of work. Then there are the phenothiazine derivatives, which are aimed at your schizophrenic types of disorders. Over 24 of them in number. They tend to reduce thought disorders, loss of self-control motivation, self-care motivation, and to reduce paranoid symptoms. And the workhorse medication is chlorpromazine, commonly known as Thorazine. And as I have already said to you, Prolixin is the long-term maintenance equivalent that tends to be used every now and then on diagnosis, close diagnosis, very close diagnosis. Now, the present issue of treatment ethically seems to resolve around the low dosage, high dosage concepts in the use of these drugs. Some of those who have facilities to keep patients in a longer term psychotherapy and to maintain extensive milieu therapy tend to rely on low dosages. Some of those who have limited and less affluent patients tend to move toward high dosage treatment and rapid crash programs of treatment and to have patient in hospital very, very much less length of time. Now, the critical ethical issue rests at the point of the ways in which more rapid and intensive forms of therapy are provided for the poor as over against the more leisurely expensive forms of treatment for the affluent. And you might ask, to what extent do affluent hospitals need the affluent patient more than the patient needs them? Well, these are drug therapy attempts at control. Another type of drug therapy attempt at control is what we call aversion therapy. And it is done with both with drugs and without drugs. And an excellent example of this is the use of antabuse with alcoholic patients. That is, that the patient's given a drug that, if mixed with alcohol later, really makes him sick and causes him to have an aversion for alcohol. We find that in behavior modification, compulsive obsessional phobic patients quite often are treated with aversive techniques of psychological reconditioning, such as if a patient is afraid of a snake, you talk about snakes first, then you show them a picture of snakes, then you show them a toy snake, then you show them a snake in a real live snake, and you gradually build up immunity. It's an immunity technique of treatment. Or for that matter, if you have a sexual deviant, pornographic pictures will be presented along with an electrical impulse temporary results are of aversion are created. Now then we go into distinctly non-drug types of therapy. They are in the areas of behavior control and the area of the use of electricity in surgery. The first form of these is electroconvulsive therapy, ECT, or commonly known as shock therapy, and which in the 40s and 50s was almost interpreted as a panacea for controlling behavior symptoms. The thing to do was to give shock therapy and then diagnose the patient. So much so that in the field of psychiatry, they developed a point of view about the overuse of this, and they called it the thumb-happy psychiatrist, you know, pushing the button on the shock box. Now, today, however, shock therapy tends to be focused on particular kinds of depressed patients. Hamilton, who has done a great deal of work with depression, seems to feel that it is superior to drug antidepressant drugs in results. I know in the two hospitals in which I work, at Louisville General Hospital, we never use it. It's just never used, period. At Norton Psychiatric Clinic, it is used only very, very occasionally. With the young man that I told you about a little while ago, it was used to no avail. It did not change his thought patterns one bit. Now, with other types of patients, such as the menopausal or involutional patient, either in women or in men, in which it is the first depressive breakdown that the person has ever had, it tends to be rather a specific, but it does not enjoy nearly the favor that it used to enjoy. The second, another form of behavior control is psychosurgery. Psychosurgery, in which invasions, and you can get my bias by the misuse of words. I said invasion, I meant to say the intervention. That's a nice neutral word. But maybe invasion is a good one, and maybe it's not. It reveals to you my feelings about psychosurgery as a means of controlling human behavior. And we, for in the 50s and 60s, this was used rather extensively, and then it fell into disrepute. But at the beginning of the 70s, there was a resurgence of use of psychosurgery and an attempt to, and many claimed successes of treatment of drug addicts, homosexuals, patients with intolerable pain, severe obsessional neurotic behavior, and other conditions. The important thing to note here is that psychosurgery is not done by psychiatrists. It's done by neurosurgeons on the recommendation of psychiatrists. In the field of psychiatry and neurosurgery, it is seen as the last form of treatment, a last-ditch attempt at treatment of a chronic patient. Now you say, well, where do you stand on this? In my 30 years of observing this particular kind of treatment, I think it is probably a treatment that should be reserved for patients who are experiencing real intolerable physical pain. Real intolerable physical pain. And patients with intractable pain do get a great deal of relief from different forms of the prefrontal lobotomy. I know at Veterans Hospital, I talked with the chief psychiatrist there, and he said they had done 17 of them, and 16 of them were with patients with intractable pain. So you can see that that is the behavior that's being controlled, is the reaction to pain. And we have one patient in Louisville that we have a videotape of who doesn't have a prefrontal lobe. And he's relatively harmless to the world, a very interesting person. And it does show you that you can get along with or without this operation. That particular patient does. Now then, there is such thing as the electronic stimulation of the brain. And this is particularly used in pain control, too. It's a technique of behavior control in which tiny electric drills are used to bore holes in the skull, and then the electrical conductors are placed at strategic locations in the brain with the objective of inducing reducing the thought, feeling, or behavior associated with that section of the brain. There is another kind of surgery that is done that is called stereotaxic psychosurgery, and it's based on the hypothesis that different kinds of behavior, let us say sexual behavior or aggressive behavior, are located and stimulated in specific locales of the brain. And this kind of research and treatment is a spin-off of a rather reliable form of surgery, as according to my informants, that has been used with Parkinson or St. Vitus dance patients in the dramatic relief of some of their symptoms, you see. Now then, Japanese surgeons are going in and claiming rather specific results in the control of temporal lobe epilepsy with this particular kind of surgery. Now, their conclusions are not definitive at all. In fact, one group of surgeons have made claims that this causes that this has caused a certain number of homosexual patients to go straight sexually. However, the headwinds of the articles that I read on the subject are very much against this as a form of controlling aggressive or unacceptable behavior. See, very much against it. Now, the field of psychology itself has done probably the most in behavior control and what they call behavior modification. And their contribution has provided such treatment modalities as grow out of Pavlovian classical conditioning or of Skinner's operant conditioning of behavior. And rather elaborate forms of treatment have been devised that time did not permit me to describe. But probably the most thoroughgoing and influential kind of behavior modification being practiced to get today spins off from the work of B.F. Skinner, which points in the direction of consequential ethics. Consequential ethics. That is, that behavior is modified in terms of its consequences. There you have positive reinforcements for acceptable behavior, negative reinforcements for unacceptable behavior, and the consequences make the difference in the learning process. And Skinner tweaks the nose of the Christian faith at this point by saying that we have the most elaborate form of positive and negative reconditioning of behavior known to man in our doctrines of heaven and hell. And that the power, quote, the power achieved by the religious agency depends upon how effectively verbal reinforcements are conditioned in the promises of reward or of punishment. In psychiatric settings, you see in large state hospitals the token economy in which patients are rewarded with modest gifts or scripts to buy things for themselves at the canteen when they do certain basic social things as getting up at a certain time, or such as bathing themselves and not having to be bathed, such as attending certain participative events, and such as being able to converse in a two-way dialogue. They are rewarded for this, and they are not rewarded for withdrawing and for their, quote, crazy, end quote, behavior, and that word is used deliberately. They are penalized for crazy behavior. Now, there are several ethical issues with reference to this kind of treatment. And both the American Psychiatric Association and the American Psychological Association have spoken on the ethics of this, and the American Psychiatric Association says that there are several things, ethical issues at stake. First, that many of the persons doing the therapy are likely to be inadequately or partially trained. Second, that there is a lack of supervisors of the clinical experience of the therapist that may cause him to overlook or ignore the need of the patient for support, guidance, advice, encouragement, reassurance, and clarification. Third, the possibility that socio-political and ethnic behaviors will become the target of treatment as a latent form of social control or forced indoctrination. And I think probably that's the most important one there. The possibility that the socio-political and ethnic behaviors will become the target of treatment and thus become a latent form of social control and forced indoctrination. And then there's the fourth problem of the ethical problem of coercive manipulation. Does the patient voluntarily participate in this, or is the patient coerced into it? A fourth one is the possibility that the programs will become non-therapeutic ways of punishing behavior and rationalizing the doctors and nurses and other members of the healing team's sadistic behavior. Now, all of that seems very specific with reference to behavior modification, but the fact of the matter is it's a good ethical summary about any kind of treatment, such as the use of shock treatment or anything else. I have seen psychiatrists in the state hospital get mad at a patient, and I've measured how long it would take them to say that patient needed shock therapy. And I didn't do that casually. I did that over a long period of time. So, these are modalities, and if I have bored you, I have simply communicated to you what's happened to me. I've been bored upon by these modalities, you see, okay? Now, please forgive me for being technical about it, but that's what I meant. That is, that you need to know about those things before you can make a judgment about them. And therefore, my task now is to identify the transversal issues that are of human rights that are at stake in the use of all of these forms of treatment. And the first issue is the issue of survival. I want to put a word of approbation and approval in for psychiatrists and psychologists that I do not see them in the clinical settings over the country where I go worrying about changing the socio-political and ethnic behavior of people as much as I see them worrying about changing behavior that would keep the patient from surviving and doing such things as eating and sleeping and clothing themselves and caring for themselves and being able to earn their own living. In other words, these modalities used at the level of survival, as they ordinarily are, is the goal, as I see it, of psychologists and psychiatrists and nurses and so on. I'll give you a case in point. An upper middle class woman comes to an emergency psychiatric center of a hospital. She's saturated internally with alcohol and permeates the air with the smell of it. She's medically on the verge of delirium tremens. She has no adult relative in the city, only a daughter who is a minor who cannot sign a document to permit treatment. She has had one automobile accident of a fender bender variety in the last 12 hours. No one was hurt, thankfully. She will not voluntarily be admitted to the hospital, though we take turns in trying to persuade her. And then the staff uses its legal authority to hold her 48 hours against her will. She's placed in an acute room and given Valium intramuscularly to offset delirium tremens. She's prevented from killing herself or someone else or both in an automobile accident, until her adult relatives can come and take responsibility for her. We required her to act externally in such a manner that her exercise of her will would coexist with the freedom of others to live and do well too. However, that's one ethical ball game. Another one is, if we were to use the power to control her life in such a way as to determine her political, religious, and economic beliefs, her capacity to use what autonomy of judgment she does have, then the ethical question can be raised as to what degree and under what conditions is the shaping of social behavior to be sanctioned. Where we as Christians would challenge the behavior modification theorists is exactly at the point that they become theorists. We will agree with them on their need, on the patient's need for survival. But when they begin to select goals for the total life of the person, the ethical issue is, what are the goals? And what was the due process used in the selection of the goals for the behavior? Now that's the first issue, namely survival. The second issue is the issue of the patient's own best interests. The World Health Organization has identified this as the criterion for the use of behavior control techniques. And that is the best interest of the patient himself or herself. And in explaining this further, they say that the patient's best interest consists, one, in never deceiving the patient. Two, in taking care that overdiagnosis of dangerousness of the patient to himself and others is not done. And three, of asking for a board of consultants in such cases as the prolonged use of tranquilizers, the use of irreversible procedures such as lobotomies, and in such cases as the long-term psychiatric care and hospitalization of a patient. Now, the third critical issue is a legal one, and that is the patient's threat of legal action. And I think we need to be very frank here in behalf of doctors and say that not only are patients' rights at stake, but doctors' rights are at stake too. If we had permitted that patient that we hospitalized to go out of the hospital and she had indeed killed herself and someone else, then the staff of that hospital would be vulnerable to a malpractice suit for not having consulted an adult member of the family. And so you have the emergence of what all up and down the halls of our hospitals we call defensive medicine. To what extent are we going to let the rampant use of malpractice suits cause patients to be deprived of the treatment that would be ordinary, to use the words of the doctor this morning, ordinary treatment? To what extent? I think that's an ethical issue that we of the church can speak to, should speak to, because in this sense we do not have any vested interest as the lawyer does or as the doctor does. And we need people who will speak who have no vested interest in the situation. Now then, a fourth issue is the patient's right to privacy. Kant called this the privatus intellectus, or the private mind. And we talk about privacy today, but the issue I would raise would be, if Skinner is, does a person have a private self? Does a person have a private intellect? Or is a person simply a group of behaviors that need to be controlled by philosopher kings? Now then, the final thing, the fifth thing I would suggest is that we in the Christian faith have a responsibility for interpreting not only minimal goals such as feeding and clothing and survival, but we have a responsibility for interpreting intermediate goals and ultimate goals for human behavior. And it could well be that some of the behavior problems that have to be dealt with in psychiatric treatment centers are due to the breakdown of our emphasis on intermediate goals and ultimate goals for people in our attempts to control, religiously control, their peripheral behaviors. For example, I can't get upset over whether the choir in my church has a square dance. I'd like to be able to, so I'd feel that I belong. But I can't. But I can get upset over the lack of large goals and the lack of ethical concern about major issues in our community. And maybe our preoccupation with controlling the insignificant behaviors has kept us from doing the thing that we're called to do, of paying attention to the long-term ultimate goals of human life, such as love and justice and mercy and hope and forgiveness. Carl Menninger wrote a book, Whatever Happened to Sin. Why shouldn't some of us write a book on Whatever Happened to Forgiveness? The final thing I would like to think of in terms of the optimum goals of the treatment patterns that we've talked about is what I would call the restoration of somatic, the restoration of the creation to its intention. All the way through the discussions today, we have been tiptoeing gingerly around and over and about the issue, do we have any right to exercise dominion over nature? Do we have any right to collaborate with nature in order to cause a human being to become that which in its original architectural design it was intended to be? Do we have any right to be co-laborers with God in the correction through the use of technologies that we have of things that are foredoomed to bring nothing but disaster to human life? And instead of being in contradiction to God, we may be co-laborers with God in using the gifts of nature, of one part of nature, to restore the deficiencies of nature in another part of nature. When you see a diabetic living comfortably on insulin, and when you see me here talking with you freely, without a stopped-up nose and without sneezing in your face and without not having had sleep for the last 5 nights because of an antihistamine, you see the results of a deficiency in nature having been corrected by the abundance of nature on another side through scientific research. And when I see a psychotic patient who is as psychotic as he or she can get come into our ward on a Sunday afternoon, and by the next Sunday afternoon they're sitting clothed and in their right mind, because some very careful, hard work had been done by, through the use of drugs, through the use of the loving care of a wonderful staff, then I thank God that creation has been restored to its objective. Because I like to think of that, the objective of the use of these tools in terms of the quality of the motivation of the hand that uses them. Any tool's purpose is shaped by the purpose of the hand that uses it. And I would like to think of the hand of the people that I work with, and it's like going to church to work with them. They are that kind of people, those doctors, those nurses. In terms of that old gospel song we like to sing, down in the human heart, crushed by the tempter, feelings lie buried that grace can restore, touched by a loving hand and awakened by kindness, chords that were broken will vibrate once more. And it's that kind of hand. And I always pray that we'll be able to use these tools with clean hands and a pure heart. That's a spiritual antiseptic technique.